Chapter 10. Before a system of phonetic spelling can be established, it is advisable that a standard pronunciation of English should exist. With that question also these papers have already dealt. But for the sake of emphasis I would repeat here the astonishment that has grown upon me as I have given my mind to these things, that, save for local exceptions, there should be no pressure even upon those who desire to become teachers in our schools or preachers in our pulpits, to attain a qualifying minimum of correct pronunciation. Now directly we pass beyond these first three elementary matters, reading, writing, and pronunciation, and come to the fourth and fifth items of our scheme, to the complete mastery of English. That is, we come upon a difficulty that is all too completely disregarded in educational discussions always by those who have had no real scholastic experience, and often by those who ought to know better. It is extremely easy for a political speaker, or a city magnate or a military reformer or an irresponsible writer, to proclaim that the schoolmaster must mend his ways forthwith, give up this pointless Latin of his, and teach his pupils the English language thoroughly with much emphasis on the orally, but it is quite another thing for the schoolmaster to obey our magnificent directions. For the plain, simple, insurmountable fact is this, that no one knows how to teach English as in our vague way we critics imagine it taught, that no working schoolmaster alive can possibly give the thing the concentrated attention, the experimental years necessary for its development, that it is worth nobody's while, and that, except in a vein of exalted self-sacrifice, it will probably not be worth anyone's while to do so for many years, unless some new Republicans conspire to make it so. The teaching of English requires its stern, its energetic modern Renaissance schoolmasters, its set of schoolbooks, its branches and grades, before it can become a discipline, even to compare with the only subject taught with any shadow of orderly progressive thoroughness in secondary schools, namely, Latin. At present our method in English is a foolish caricature of the Latin method. We spend a certain amount of time teaching children classificatory bosh about the eight sorts of nominative case, a certain amount of time teaching them the derivation of words they do not understand, glance shyly at Anglo-Saxon, and at Grimm's Law, indulge in a specific reminiscence of the Latin method called parsing, supplement with a more modern development called the analysis of sentences, give a course of exercises in paraphrasing, for the most part the conversion of good English into bad, and wind up with lessons in imposition that must be seen to be believed. Essays are produced, and the teacher noses blindly through the product for false concords, prepositions at the end of sentences, and, if a person of peculiarly fine literary quality, for the word reliable, and the split infinitive. These various exercises are so little parts of an articulate whole, that they may be taken in almost any order and any relative quantity. And in the result, if some pupil should, by a happy knack of apprehension, win through this confusion to a sense of literary quality, to the enterprise of even trying to write, the thing is so rare and wonderful that almost inevitably he or she, in a fine outburst of discovered genius, takes to the literary life. For the rest, they will understand nothing but the flattest prose. They will be deaf to everything but the crudest meanings. They will be the easy victims of the boom, and terribly shy of a pen. They will revere the dead great, and respect the new academic, read the living quack, miss and neglect the living promise, and become just a fresh volume of that atmosphere of azote, in which our literature stifles. Now the schoolmaster is not to blame for this any more than he is to blame for sticking to Latin. It is no more possible for schoolmasters and schoolmistresses, whose lives are encumbered with a voluminous mass of low-grade mental toil, and worries and reasonable and unreasonable responsibilities, to find the energy and mental freedom necessary to make any vital changes in the methods that textbooks, traditions, and examinations force upon them, than it is for a general medical practitioner to invent and make out of the native or the steel implements some operation of frequent occurrence in his practice may demand. If they are made, and accessible by purchase, and not too expensive, he will get them. If they are not, he will have to fumble along with the next best thing. And if nothing that is any good can be got, then there is nothing for it, though he be the noblest character, the finest intelligence, that ever lived behind a brass plate, but either to shirk that operation altogether, or to run the chance of making a disastrous mess of it. Scolding the schoolmaster, jibing at the schoolmaster, guying, afflicting and exasperating the schoolmaster in every conceivable way, is an amusement so entirely congenial to my temperament, that I do not for one moment propose to abandon it. It is a devil I have, and I admit it. He insults schoolmasters and bishops in particular, and I do not cast him out, but at the same time I would most earnestly insist that all that sort of thing does nothing whatever to advance education, that it is a mere outbreak of personal grace notes so far as this discussion goes. The real practical needs in the matter are a properly worked out method, a proper set of school books, and then a progressive alteration of examinations in English, to render that method and that set of schoolbooks imperative. These are needs the schoolmaster and schoolmistress can do amazingly little to satisfy. Of course, when these things are ready, and the pressure to enforce them begins to tell on the schools, schoolmasters and schoolmistresses, having that almost instinctive dread of any sort of change, that all hard-worked and rather worried people acquire, will obstruct and have to be reckoned with. But that is a detail in the struggle, and not a question of general objective. And to satisfy those real practical needs, what is wanted is in the first place an organizer, a reasonable sum of money, say £10,000 for 10 years, and access for experimental purposes to a variety of schools. This organizer would set himself to secure the whole time and energy, and interest of a dozen or so of good men. They would include several expert teachers, a clear-headed pedagogic expert or so, a keen psychologist perhaps with a penetrating mind, for example, one might try, and kidnap Professor William James in his next sabbatical year, one or two industrious young students, a literary critic perhaps, a philologist, a grammarian, and set them all, according to their several gifts and faculties, towards this end. At the end of the first year this organizer would print, and publish for the derision of the world in general, and the bitter attacks of the men he had omitted from the enterprise in particular, for review in the newspapers and for trial in enterprising schools, a course in the English language and composition. His team of collaborators, revised perhaps, probably weeded by a quarrel or so, and supplemented by the ablest of the hostile critics, would then, working with all their time and energy, revise the course for the second year. And you would repeat the process for 10 years. In the end, at the cost of L100,000, really a quite trivial sum for the object in view, there would exist the scheme, the method, the primers and textbooks, the school dictionary, the examination syllabus, and all that is now needed for the proper teaching of English. You would have, moreover, in the copyrights of the course an asset that might go far to recoup those who financed the enterprise. It is precisely this difficulty about textbooks, and a general scheme that is the real obstacle to any material improvement in our mathematical teaching. Professor Perry, in his opening address to the engineering section of the British Association at Belfast, expressed an opinion that the average boy of 15 might be got to the infinitesimal calculus. As a matter of fact, the average English boy of 15 has only just looked at elementary algebra. But everyone who knows anything of educational science knows that by the simple expedient of throwing overboard all that non-educational, mind-sickening and complex rubbish about money and weights and measures, practice, interest, rule of three, and all the rest of the solemn claptrap invented by the masters of the old academy for young gentlemen, to fool the foolish predecessors of those who clamor for commercial education today, and by setting aside the pretense in teaching geometry, that algebraic formulae and the decimal notation are not yet invented, little boys of 9 may be got to apply quadratic equations to problems, plot endless problems upon squared paper, and master and apply the geometry covered by the earlier books of Euclid with the utmost ease. But to do this with a class of boys at present demands so much special thought, so much private planning, so much sheer toil on the part of the teacher, that it becomes practically impossible. The teacher must arrange the whole course himself, invent his examples, or hunt them laboriously through a dozen books. He must be not only teacher, but textbook. I know of no school arithmetic which does not groan under a weight of sham practical work, and that does not, with an absurd priggishness, exclude the use of algebraic symbols. Except for one little volume, I know of no sane book which deals with arithmetic and elementary algebra under one cover, or gives any helpful exercises or examples in squared paper calculations. Such books, I am told, exist in the seclusion of publishers' stock rooms, but if I, enjoying as I do much more leisure and opportunity of inquiry than the average mathematical master, cannot get at them, how can we expect him to do so? And the thing to do now is obviously to discover or create these books, and force them kindly, but firmly into the teacher's hands. The problem is much simpler in the case of mathematical teaching than in the case of English, because the educational theory and method have been more thoroughly discussed. There is no need for the 10 years of experiment and trial I have suggested for the organization of English teaching. The mathematical reformer may begin now at a point the English language reformer will not reach for some years. Suppose now a suitably authenticated committee were to work out on the basis of Professor Perry's syllabus perhaps a syllabus of school mathematics, and then make a thorough review of all the mathematical textbooks on sale throughout the English-speaking world, admitting some perhaps as of real permanent value for teaching of the new type, provisionally recognizing others as endurable, but with clear recommendations for their revision and improvement, and condemning the others specifically by name. Let them make it clear that the syllabus and report will be respected by all public examining bodies. Let them spend £100 or so in the intelligent distribution of their report, and the scholastic profession will not be long before it is equipped with the recommended books. Meanwhile, the English and American scholastic publishers will become extremely active, the worn books will be revised, and new books will be written in competition for the enormous prize of the committee's final approval, an activity that a second review, after an interval of 5 or 6 years, will recognize and reward. Such measures as these will be worth reams of essays in educational papers and parents' reviews, worth thousands of inspiring and suggestive lectures at pedagogic conferences. If, indeed, such essays and such lectures do any good at all. The more one looks into scholastic affairs, the more one is struck, not only by the futility, but the positive mischievousness of much of what passes for educational liberalism. The schoolmaster is criticized vehemently for teaching the one or two poor useless subjects he can in a sort of way teach, and practically nothing is done to help or equip him to teach anything else. By reason of this uproar, the world is full now of anxious muddled parents, their poor brains buzzing with echoes of Froebel, Tolstoy, Herbert Spencer, Ruskin, Herbert, Colonel Parker, Mr. Harris, Matthew Arnold, and the Morning Post, trying to find something better. They know nothing of what is right, they only know very, very clearly that the ordinary school is extremely wrong. They are quite clear they don't want cram, though they haven't the remotest idea what cram is, and they have a pretty general persuasion that failure at examination is a good test of a sound education. and in response to their bleeding demand there grows a fine crop of quack schools, schools organized on lines of fantastic extravagance, in which beekeeping takes the place of Latin, and gardening supersedes mathematics, in which boys play tennis naked to be cured of false shame, and the numerical exercises called bookkeeping, and commercial correspondence are taught to the sons of parents who can pay 100 guineas a year, as commercial science. The subjects of study in these schools come and go like the ravings of a disordered mind. Greek history in an hour, so a week for a term, is followed by Talian literature, and this gives place to the production of a Shakespearean play that ultimately overpowers and disorganizes the whole curriculum. Ethical lessons and the school pulpit flourish, of course. A triennial walk to a chalk pit is field geology, and vague half-holiday wanderings are botany rambles. A art of the copper-punching variety replaces any decent attempt to draw, and an extreme expressiveness in music compensates for an almost deliberate slovenliness of technique. Even the ladies' seminaries of the Georgian days could scarcely have produced a parallel to the miscellaneous incapacity of the victim of these modern schools, and it becomes daily more necessary for those who have the interests of education at heart to disavow with the most unmistakable emphasis these catch parent impostures. With the other subjects under the headings of A and B, it is not necessary to deal at any length here. Drawing begins at home, and a child should have begun to sketch freely before the formal schooling commences. It is the business of the school to teach drawing, and not to teach RT, which, indeed, is always an individual and spontaneous thing, and it need only concern itself directly with those aspects of drawing that require direction. Of course, an hour set aside from the school time in which boys or girls may do whatever they please with paper, ink, pens, pencils, compasses, and watercolor would be a most excellent and profitable thing, but that scarcely counts except in the quack schools as teaching. As a matter of fact, teaching absolutely spoils all that sort of thing. A course in model drawing and in perspective, however, is really a training in seeing things. It demands rigorous instruction, and it must be the backbone of school drawing, and, in addition, studies may be made from flowers that would not be made without direction. Topography and much else may be learned by copying good explicit maps. Chronology, to supplement the child's private reading of history, by the construction of time charts. And much history also by drawing and coloring historical maps. With geometrical drawing one passes insensibly into mathematics. And so much has been done, not only to revolutionize the teaching of modern languages, but also to popularize the results, that I may content myself with a mere mention of the names of Ripman, Esalch, Heelsel, and Gowan as typical of the new ways. There remains the question of C, the amount of information that is to take a place in schooling. Now there is one object that it would be convenient to include, were it only for the sake of the mass of exercise and illustration it supplies to the mathematical course, and that is the science of physics. In addition, the science of physics, since it culminates in a clear understanding and use of the terminology of the aspects of energy, and a clear sense of adequate causation, is fundamentally necessary to modern thought. Practical work is, no doubt, required for the proper understanding of physical science, and so far it must enter into schooling, but it may be pointed out here that in many cases the educational faddist is overdoing the manual side of science study to a ridiculous extent. Things have altered very much at the Royal College of Science, no doubt, since my student days, but 15 years ago the courses in elementary physics and in elementary geology were quite childishly silly in this respect. Both these courses seem to have been inspired by that eminent educationist, Mr. Squeers, and the sequel to Spelling Indo was always to O and Clean One. The science in each course in those days could have been acquired just as well in a fortnight as in half a year. One muddled away 3 or 4 days etching a millimeter scale with hydrofluoric acid on glass, to no earthly end, that I could discover, and a week or so in making a needless barometer. In the course in geology, days and days were spent in drawing ideal crystalline forms, and coloring them in watercolors, apparently in order to get a totally false idea of a crystal, and weeks in the patient copying of microscopic rock sections in watercolors. Effectual measures of police were taken to prevent the flight of the intelligent student from these tiresome duties. The mischief done in this way is very great. It deadens the average students and exasperates and maddens the eager ones. I am inclined to think that a very considerable proportion of what passes as practical science work, for which costly laboratories are built and expensive benches fitted, consists of very similar solemnities, and it cannot be too strongly urged that practical work that does not illuminate is mere waste of the student's time. This physics course would cover an experimental quantitative treatment of the electric current. It would glance in an explanatory way at many of the phenomena of physical geography, and it would be correlated with a study of the general principles of chemistry. A detailed knowledge of chemical compounds is not a part of general education. It keeps better in reference books than in the non-specialized head, and it is only the broad conceptions of analysis and combination, and of the relation of energy to chemical changes, that have to be attained. Beyond this, and the application of map drawing to give accurate ideas, and to awaken interest in geography and history, it is open to discussion whether any fact subject need be taught as schooling at all. Ensure the full development of a man's mental capacity, and he will get his fact as he needs it. And if his mind is undeveloped, he can make no use of any fact he has. The subject called human physiology may be at once dismissed as absurdly unsuitable for school use. One is always meeting worthy people who aren't see why children should not know something about their own bodies, and who are not apparently aware that the medical profession, after some generations of fairly systematic inquiry, knows remarkably little. Save for some general anatomy, it is impossible to teach school children anything true about the human body, because the explanation of almost any physiological process demands a knowledge of physical and chemical laws much sounder and subtler than the average child can possibly attain. And as for botany, geology, history, and geography beyond the range already specified, these are far better relegated to the school library and the initiative of each child. Every child has its specific range of interest and its specific way of regarding things. In geology, for example, one boy may be fascinated by the fossil hunting, another will find his interest in the effects of structure in scenery, and a third, with more imagination, will give his whole mind to the reconstruction of the past, and will pore over maps of Pleistocene Europe, and pictures of Silurian landscape with the keenest appreciation. Each will be bored, or at least not greatly interested, by what attracts the others. Let the children have an easily accessible library that is the crying need of 999 out of 1,000 schools today, a need every school-seeking parent may do something to remedy, and in that library let there be one or two good densely illustrated histories, illustrated travels, bound volumes of such a publication as Noon's Wide World magazine. I name these publications haphazard. There are probably others as good or better. Hutchinson and Company _S Living Animals of the World, the Rev. H. N. Hutchinson's Extinct Monsters, the Badminton volumes on big game shooting, mountaineering, and yachting, Kerner's Otany, collections of the 100 best pictures sort, collections of views of towns, and of scenery in different parts of the world, and the like. Then let the schoolmaster set aside 5 hours a week as the minimum for reading, and let the pupils read during that time just whatever they like, provided only that they keep silence and read. If the schoolmaster or schoolmistress comes in at all here, it should be to stimulate systematic reading occasionally by setting a group of 5 or 6 pupils to edit up some particular subject or report on animals that might still be domesticated, for example, and by showing them conversationally how to read with a slip of paper at hand, gathering facts. This sort of thing it is impossible to reduce to method and system, and, consequently, it is the proper field for the teacher's initiative. It is largely in order to leave time and energy for this that I am anxious to reduce the more rigorous elements in schooling to standard and textbook. Now all this schooling need not take more than 20 hours a week for its backbone or hard work portion, its English, mathematics, science, and exact drawing, and 12 hours a week for its easier, more individual employments of sketching, painting, and reading, and this leaves a large margin of time for military drill and for physical exercises. If we are to get the best result from the child's individuality, we must leave a large portion of that margin at the child's own disposal. It must be free to go for walks, to uck about, as schoolboys say, to play games, and, within limits, to consort with companions of its own choosing, to follow its interests in short. It is in this direction that British middle-class education fails most signally at the present time. The English schoolboy and schoolgirl are positively hunted through their days. They do not play, using the word to indicate a spontaneous employment into which imagination enters at all. They have games, but they are so regulated that the imagination is eliminated. They have exercises of various stereotyped sorts. They are taken to and fro to these things, in the care of persons one would call ushers unhesitatingly were it not that they also pretended to teach. The rest of their waking time is preparation, or supervised reading or walking under supervision. Their friendships are watched. They are never, never left alone. The avowed ideal of many boarding schoolmasters is to end them to bed tired out. Largely this is due to a natural dread of accidents and scrapes that will make trouble for the school, but there is also another cause. If I may speak frankly and entirely as an unauthoritative observer, I would say it is a regrettable thing that so large a proportion of British secondary schoolmasters and mistresses are unmarried. The normal condition of a healthy adult is marriage, and for all those who are not defective upon this side, and that means an incapacity to understand many things, celibacy is a state of unstable equilibrium, and too often a quite unwholesome condition. Wherever there are celibate teachers, I am inclined to suspect a fussiness, an unreasonable watchfulness, a disposition to pry, an exaggeration of what are called angers, a painful idealization of purity. It is a part of the normal development of the human being to observe with some particularity certain phenomena, to entertain certain curiosities, to talk of them to trusted equals, never, be it noted, except by perversion to parents or teachers, and there is not the slightest harm in these quite natural things, unless they are forced back into an abashed solitude, or associated by suggestion with conceptions of shame and disgust. That is what happens in too many of our girls' schools and preparatory schools today, and it is to that end, mainly, that youthful intimacies are discouraged, youthful freedom is restricted, and imagination and individuality warped and crippled. It is astonishing how much of their adolescence grown-up people will contrive to forget. So much for schooling, and what may be done to better it in this new Republican scheme of things. The upward continuation of it into a general college course is an integral part of a larger question that we shall discuss at a later stage, the larger question of the general progressive thought of the community as a whole. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.